Yancey took off running. Mary watched curiously through the window, an empty oyster shell in each of her hands. Chapter 26. Prawny was confident he could disarm the tattooed redneck, whose behavior was increasingly erratic. Deerbone had demanded to do the meet inside the Sprinter van instead of the hotel because he didn't want to be seen in public. The Key West cops, he kept saying, were hunting everywhere for him. John David Ampergroat told Prawny he wasn't comfortable bargaining with a paranoid bumblefuck who had a loaded pistol on his lap. Prawny promised to take care of it. He outweighed the dumb cracker by 100 pounds. Nobody in the group had gotten much sleep. After the Gulfstream landed, Amp and Prawny had returned to the pier house, while Blister Krill ordered the driver of the Sprinter to top off the gas tank. He said there was a roadside motel way up in Key Largo where they'd be safe for the night. When Buck Nance objected, Blister said, "Tough shit." And this was his idol he was talking to. Along the way, they stopped on Stock Island to drop Mona at the duplex. 92 miles later, Blister was still pounding the bourbon and Reese's cups and rhapsodizing about the plane ride on the G5 and the new Ford Dually he was going to buy with his TV money. Buck had tuned him out early in the trip. Coolman had stayed busy answering emails on his phone. The motel Blister chose hadn't been renovated since the Nixon presidency. Coolman rented 4 rooms, including one for the driver, who was swayed by a $1,000 tip to stay for the night. At 3 a.m., Buck knocked on Coolman's door, complaining that Blister was howling like a bobcat in a stump grinder. "It only gets worse when I bang on the wall," Buck said. "Christ, don't do that. He's so wasted, he'll start shooting everywhere." With a slump, Buck paced back and forth in Coolman's room. He was holding a bag of ice cubes on his sore elbow. "This whole damn plan," he said. "What a nightmare." Coolman promised it was almost over. "By this time tomorrow, your phony twin bro will be in jail, and you'll have a deal that's going to make you crazy rich. Soon as Amp signs off, we're golden." "Even though the Deerbone thing isn't real, Amp's going to figure that out." "Buck, he already knows the guy's not your brother. The party doesn't know that Blister's going to jail. Trust me, Amp will thank me later for getting that dickweed out of his hair. So will the network." "Why are you so sure he's getting busted?" "One phone call and it's over," Coolman said. "This is what I do, okay? Calm the waters. Now please, go get some rest."
"What about Miracle?"
"You want her back?" Coolman's tone was forbearing. "All right, let me work on that too."
"Never mind, I'd have to be insane."
"Sad, but true."
"It's Crystal I want," Buck admitted dolefully. "I want us to be Rombergs again."
"Get a grip, please."
In the morning, they made the slog through high-season traffic back to Key West, where Blister refused to leave the Sprinter because he thought he heard police sirens. Negotiations with Amp commenced inside the vehicle at the Pier House parking lot. Every time Amp turned hard-ass, Coolman played the Bayou Blood card. It worked. Buck got his salary doubled, a bigger cut of the Brethren reruns, and guaranteed helicopter service back and forth to the chicken farm. Coolman would be crowned senior executive producer, Amp grudgingly accepting a standard producer credit as long as his name came first in the opening scroll. The trouble in the van erupted while Coolman was on the phone with Andrew Yancey, moments after Amp had initialed and signed Buck's deal memo. Amp was skimming through the terms of Blister's contract when Blister suddenly declared he wanted more than $50,000 an episode, and also 24/7 access to a jet. It didn't have to be the Gulfstream, but it had to be the same color.
Those green stripes are sick, he said.
Amp never lifted his gaze from the document.
No jet, Dearbone. Not even Buck gets a jet, and he's the bloody star of the show.
Out came Blister's gun, and Prawny went into action, hurling himself upon the stringy redneck. In the cramped confines, they tangled clumsily, Prawny unable to separate Blister from the weapon. The driver hopped out and bolted.
Ah, shit, Coolman said.
Amp and Buck clambered to the rear of the van, ducking behind the seats. Prawny drew his Glock, setting up a taut stare-down with Blister. Neither looked exceptionally steady.
The fuck are you guys doing? Stop! Cried Coolman,
who correctly perceived he was in the presence of two rank amateurs with firearms. Blister was the first to pull the trigger, with inconclusive results. The slug entered Prawny's open mouth and exited his left cheek before demolishing the phone in Coolman's hand. Prawny's long-neglected Glock misfired twice, so he employed it as a mallet on Blister's midsection, replicating the same compact stroke he had mastered pounding beef for the Thai salad at Morton's. The redneck's pistol fired again, and Prawny felt a searing pain in his shoulder, the Glock falling from his fist. He passed out while Amp was yelling, "Knock this shit off, Dearbone, or the deal's off!" Buck and Coolman were yelling, too. Everyone in the parking lot would have heard the men had they not been inside a vehicle with superior soundproofing. They fell silent when the sliding door of the Sprinter was flung open. Yancey looked inside and took a cop-style headcount. Buck Nance was cowering in the back of the van. Beside him crouched a glossy white male in his 30s. Lane Coolman sat, pale and shaken, in one of the middle rows. Out cold on the floor, a heavy-set African-American male, bleeding from the mouth and upper body. Finally, there was Benny the Blister, disheveled and gasping, though erect on his feet. The buttons of his absurd tropical shirt had been torn off, the rooster tattoo on his belly pulped to a crimson gargoyle. Gripped crookedly in one of Blister's hands was the semi-automatic.
"Just in time!"
he yucked at Yancey and waggled the gun barrel toward the front seat.
"Drive, asshole! Me and my team got a plane to catch!"
The Sandman also had a plane to catch, an American Airlines charter from Miami to Havana. Juveline was ticketed on a later flight, a precaution at which she'd scoffed. To tease Martin Trabeau, she arrived early at the airport, flaunting Tropicana-worthy cleavage. In flame-colored heels, she clacked into the gate area and sat down beside a startled Roman Catholic priest. Soon, they were engaged in earnest conversation, Juveline shooting a smoky glance at Trabeau while her painted fingernails feathered a sleeve of the old cleric's cassock. It was more than Trabeau could endure, and he signaled heatedly for Juveline to switch to the chair beside his. She did, saying,
"Do I know you, mister?"
"Behave yourself, okay? Until we get there."
"Guys in black really turned me on. Plus, he talks like a cute old leprechaun."
"That would be Irish," Trabeau said thinly. "Sweetie, what did you tell Big Noogie?"
"He thinks I'm going to see my sister Kimmy. She lives in St. Louis."
"But what happens when he tries to call and you don't answer? Your cell phone won't work in Cuba."
Juveline said,
"The Noog won't call because he can't stand Kimmy. Plus, he'll be too busy. Some of his New York peeps are coming down to hang at the Pyrenees. So thank God you put in that sweet new beach, right?"
The Morning Herald was open on Trabeau's lap. Juveline slithered a hand beneath the newspaper and favored him with an intimate tickle. At this point, he became immune to rational thought. She showed him her neck, saying,
"See? I made it so you can't even tell there's a mark."
"My bad. I got carried away," he said.
"Well, I think it's kind of hot. They got internet where we're going?
Here and there, but you can't post any pictures, okay? Havana doesn't look anything like St. Louis.
Marty, I hate it when you talk to me like I'm just a stupid piece of ass.
He didn't think she was stupid, yet in his experience, even worldly, hard-edged women went overboard with the social media. Juveline was likely the first in her circle of girlfriends to visit Cuba, and it would require extraordinary self-restraint not to share her tropical experience online. Even if Big Noogie didn't follow his mistress on Facebook, the mistresses of his mafia cohorts might be keeping tabs. Trabeau plotted to disable Juveline's phone once she arrived on the island, in case they wandered into a Wi-Fi hotspot. Otherwise, he was excited about their exotic assignation. Up to now, the relationship had existed only in a hotel room, brief trysts made more thrilling by the danger. That first night in Havana would be their first together with no hurried departures. Although there was much Trabeau didn't know about Juveline, he wasn't concerned. Having gotten past the fact her boyfriend was a murderous gangster, the Sandman couldn't imagine any other revelation that would scare him away. He didn't care if she was bisexual, bipolar, or biohazardous. He didn't care if she wanted to draw Mike Huckabee's face on his balls. She rocked his sleazy little universe. That's all that mattered. Unfortunately, as Trabeau later discovered, Juveline did have one particular habit that would have iced his ardor and panicked him into primal flight. In his defense, it was nothing he'd overlooked. Rather, it was something he couldn't possibly have known about her, since the two of them had never spent more than an hour in bed, always awake, which left him unaware, catastrophically unaware, that Juveline talked in her sleep, and that the previous night she had unconsciously blurted three words, repeating them loudly enough to awaken the man lying beside her, an individual known to state and federal authorities as Dominic Big Noogie Ayola. The three words exclaimed by Juveline in slumber were,
"Harder, Marty, harder!"
Had he known of this occurrence, Martin Trabeau would have traded his ticket to Cuba for a seat on the next flight anywhere else. Haiti, Paraguay, fucking Yemen. The farther away, the better. But the Sandman, unaware, proceeded toward his secret island rendezvous. 30 minutes out of Miami, as the plane began to descend, Trabeau was at peace. He smiled to himself at first sight of the island, miles and miles of white ribbon shore. Somewhere below, in some drab cubicle of that leaden communist bureaucracy, sat an enterprising bureaucrat who would hook him up with all the sand he could barge for the right bribe. Trabeau was sure of it. After clearing immigration, he changed his dollars to Cuban currency, collected his suitcase, and hopped in a two-toned taxi, a 52 Chevy convertible. With a couple hours to burn, he asked the driver for a road tour of Old Havana, which was spectacular but also a little depressing. The whole place cried out for a pressure washing, and many of the magnificent grand old buildings were falling apart in chunks. Laundry was strung everywhere across the balconies, while the peeling walls bannered faded revolutionary slogans. The taxi took Trabeau speeding along the legendary Malecón, under a spray of crashing waves, and then through a tunnel to the other side of Havana Bay. From there, the city looked timeless and unworn. He did a selfie at the Moro Castle, and another in front of Che Guevara's house. On the trip back, the driver stopped on the Prado, where Trabeau bought a handful of cohibas from a chatty street vendor. The loose-fitting bands betrayed the cigars as counterfeit, but the Sandman didn't care. He simply liked the way they looked in his breast pocket. He planned to give one to Big Noogie back in the States.
At a café near Parque Central, Trabeau ordered a cubata made with 7-year-old Havana Club. It went down silky, so he ordered another. The place was packed with foreigners, including many Americans. In English, the barman complimented Trabeau on his attire, a bone-colored linen suit. The café featured many photographs of Ernest Hemingway at play. Trabeau said he'd read every single one of the great man's books, a line of Bull the bartender heard no less than a dozen times a day. Another antique cab, a blue Dodge Royal Lancer, carried Trabeau back to the airport, where he waited with a carnal buzz for Juveline. When her flight landed, he stationed himself at the forefront of the throng outside the terminal building. A half hour passed, then an hour. Arriving passengers, tourists and Cubans, streamed out the doors. But where was Big Noogie's mistress? The way she was dressed, she'd be impossible to miss. Trabeau was more irritated than worried. Maybe there was a problem with her paperwork at immigration. Was it possible she lost her damn visa? He'd watched her place it in her handbag before they said goodbye in Miami. Unfucking believable. The Sandman checked the time on his watch. As he looked up, the last passenger from the Miami flight walked out of the airport. It wasn't Juveline. It was, however, somebody Trabeau recognized. He wished he didn't.
"Hello, Marty," said the man with the ivory toothpick. "Let's you and me take a ride to the beach."
Brock Richardson lunched alone at the Casa Marina, then drove back to Miami Beach. The warm and pretty day was wasted on him. Even the muscle wine of the newest Porsche in his fleet failed to raise a smile. On Card Sound Road, he hit a mirthless 135 with no spike in his pulse. Upon arriving home, Richardson stalked into the bathroom and clawed free of his suit. The shirt flew off next, revealing a rampage of acne across his chest and back. While examining the cock-like skin tag under his arm, he was shocked to observe the bluish downward trail of a vein. In true junkie form, he scrambled for more Petrolux. By the time Deb walked in, violet gunk oozed from every crevice, and Richardson stank like a truckload of rancid Granny Smiths. Deb snatched the Soft Glide applicator from his fist and said, "Brock, we need to talk."
"Bad news, babe. My meeting in Key West, it didn't go too well."
"Shocker," she said. "Want to hear what happened to me last night?"
"How about a quick one? I'm a wreck."
"Clean yourself up and put on some clothes, for God's sake."
They reconvened later in the dining room at opposite ends of the rosewood table. Richardson went first.
"The diamond ring's history. Dominic took it. He gave it to his son's fiancée."
"And you couldn't change his mind. You with your legendary powers of persuasion."
"That I don't need. The sarcasm and snark. It took bull-sized cojones for me to brace this dude. You should look him up on Google. He's badass squared."
Deb chuckled coldly.
"And his name's actually Dominic?"
"What did you expect? Rory? Sven? He's in the goddamn mafia."
"So this means you'll be buying me a new rock, right?"
"I guess so,"
was Richardson's barren reply. The boner under his bathrobe throbbed, oblivious to his melancholy. He knew of no other big-time TV lawyer in such a sorry predicament, hooked on the very substance that was the target of his own commercials. If the truth got out, Richardson would be sensationally discredited, if not disbarred. The legitimate law firms to which he farmed his Petrolux clients would cut off all contact, creating a savage drop in his cash flow. Potentially, it could cost him millions. By comparison, the loss of the engagement ring was negligible, a blip on Richardson's bank statement.
Deb said, "Well, here's my news. Forget about that vacation place in Big Pine, because I'm not going back there, not ever."
"Really? All right."
"Don't you want to know why? I didn't tell you this because I didn't want to piss you off. But yesterday I drove down to see that a-hole Yancey about selling us his place. I was ready to make him a better offer."
"Let me guess what that was," said Richardson.
"But his house is full of monster rats, the nastiest things you ever saw, all the way from Africa, swear to God, and they've got like zero fear of humans. It wouldn't matter if we bulldozed everything, Brock, those hairy bastards would come back. See, they live in the woods. Yancey says they're all over the islands. Two of the damn things were chilling in his living room, okay, like they owned the place, and big enough to carry off a baked ham. I got so freaked I drove straight home, took two Valiums, and crashed. And still, I had the worst dreams. Bottom line, I am so done with the keys."
Richardson was stunningly calm. "Actually, I'm relieved to hear you say that, because I've decided to sell our lot."
"Wow. Really? Wow."
Deb's mind raced ahead. She'd heard good reports about Captiva on the West Coast, Boca Grande, too. Supposedly, there was a 5-star spa at the Gasparilla Inn. She asked Brock how much they could get for the Big Pine property.
"I'd be taking a hit," he replied, a miserable understatement.
"How big a hit? You paid, what, for it, 90?
110, Deb."
"And we're listing it for how much?"
"I'm not listing it. There's already a buyer."
Deb was happily amazed.
"When did all this happen? Do they know about the Indian teeth? That they can't build on the land?"
"Not a problem. Not for this guy."
"Unbelievable! Who is he?"
"A friend of Dominic's, apparently."
Richardson wore a smile of sickly resignation.
"You mean like a good friend?"
"Dominic wants me to close the deal as fast as possible."
"For how much?"
$2,500.
Deb felt like throwing up.
"What the fuck? He cannot be serious."
"He most definitely is."
"But what about your mortgage on the lot?"
"Oh, I'll be paying that off next week with a cashier's check to the bank."
"This isn't a sale, it's a robbery. Just tell the man no, Brock. What if you said no?"
"You're a bright person. Use your imagination."
She tipped her head into her arms.
"So who is this creep," she said, "that's getting our dream lot for practically free? Another gangster, probably. You ever heard of him?"
"He's not a gangster, Deb. It's worse than that."
"What are you talking about? How could it be worse?"
The Sprinter handled like a coupe. Yancey purposely chose the slowest, most convoluted route to the Key West airport. Benny the Blister sat up front in the passenger seat. His window was open and the gun was still on his lap. Yancey used the rear view to keep an eye on the others. The wounded, bald bodyguard sat upright and glum, a bloody handkerchief pressed to his cheek. Lane Kuhlman remained hunkered in the last row, conferring in low tones with the man called Amp. Buck Nance appeared ashen and deflated, for good reason. Blister was his creation, the ultimate white trash nightmare. As the van passed a Hasidic family on Elizabeth Street, Blister leaned out and screamed something horrible. Buck's reaction was instant and scalding, though Blister's ensuing tirade sounded to Yancey like a spoof of Buck's own YouTube sermons at the First Chickapaw Tabernacle of Hope and Holiness. Blister's next target was two men holding hands on Truman Avenue. Coolman and Amp pleaded with him to stop yelling, though for some reason they called him Deerbone instead of Benny. Yancey didn't bother to ask why. Buck's stubbled chin had dropped to his chest, and his breathing had become heavy, as if he was willing himself into a stupor.
"I can't wait to get my white ass up to that bayou,"
Blister seethed,
"where there ain't no Jews or faggots."
Yancey said, "You are quite a specimen."
"Yo, this ain't the right way to the airport."
Yancey said he was taking the back roads to steer clear of the cops. They ended up trailing one of the slow-moving conch trains, which gave Yancey an opening to bring up the death of Abdul Halim Shamoon. "Doesn't it bother you even a little bit?" he asked Blister. "I should show you some pictures of him and his family."
"Shut the hell up right this second."
"What's the matter, Benny?"
"Turn here. Get off of this street."
From the rear of the van, the man called Amp asked if they could stop to get medical aid for Prawny, the bodyguard. Blister said, "No way, Jose," but Yancey made a few slick moves, and minutes later they were on Stock Island, rolling up to the hospital. Blister was going ballistic until Yancey pointed out a police cruiser idling in the lane behind an ambulance. Clutching his shoulder, Prawny got out of the Sprinter and trudged toward the emergency room.
"I'll email a plane ticket,"
Amp shouted after him. Hiding low behind the dashboard, Blister ordered Yancey to hit the gas.
"I don't see the airport in 5 minutes,"
he rasped.
"I'm gonna blow your damn brains out."
"Can I ask where you wild and crazy guys are going?"
"Los Angeles,"
Coolman's voice from the back of the van.
"On a private jet plane,"
Blister added.
"But first, they're dropping off me and Buck at the chicken farm. Clearoy and Buddy and Junior, they gotta meet their new kin."
Yancey said it was safe to get up. Blister hopped back in the passenger seat and positioned the semi-automatic between his legs. Amp reported a text from his pilot. The Gulfstream was fueled and ready to go. Yancey was struggling to come up with a plan that wouldn't end with more gunshots. He knew Coolman and Amp would be useless in a group struggle for Blister's weapon, while Buck was totally out of the game, listless and glassy-eyed. They were on South Roosevelt, maybe a mile from the airport, when Yancey said, "Benny, you're not leaving Key West. I'm just telling you up front, I can't let you go."
"You don't see this pistole aimed right at your ear hole?"
"Yes, it's a concern."
"Then what the fuck?"
Blister's face twisted like a dirty mop.
"How are you gonna stop me from getting on that goddamn jet plane? Tell me how, motherfucker!"
Yancey shrugged. "Whatever it takes."
"Dude! I already stabbed you. Now you're gonna make me shoot you, too? And all 'cause of one skinny dead Muslim."
"This is difficult for you to grasp, I know."
"What? You saying I'm the stupid one?"
"That's how you're acting," said Yancey. "It would be the opposite of smart, for instance, to shoot your driver. Why? Because a driver with a gunshot could easily lose control and crash. This van's going 49 miles per hour, and you, Benjamin Krill, aren't wearing a seatbelt."
"Then stop right now so I can put a bullet in your skull and get it over with."
Yancey, in his doom state, almost cracked a smile. In the mirror, he saw Amp and Coolman scrambling to buckle up.
"I said, pull off of this goddamn road!"
Blister roared. "Now that would be stupid," said Yancey, slapping at the gun barrel. There was a bang. The van spun sideways and rolled a full 360. There was a louder bang when it struck a palm tree. A coconut fell from the branches, spidering Yancey's side of the windshield. He knew instantly that the first loud noise wasn't the semi-automatic, because his ears weren't ringing and he didn't smell gunfire. It was only a traffic accident. Nobody appeared to be injured except Blister, who was spitting raw chunks of tongue. His nose was mashed, his jawline gashed from ear to chin. Bright blood dappled the stud rooster inked on his belly. The pistol, knocked loose by the impact, was nowhere to be seen. Yancey unbuckled, stepped from the van, and managed to slide open one of the doors. Blister was the first to clamber out, charging toward the car that had caused the crash. It was an old gold Chrysler 300. He saw that the driver was a good-looking woman with dark red hair. Her skirt was hitched up around her waist. Blister quit ranting and gaped.
"Super sorry," the woman said sheepishly. "I'm late for a date. Are you okay? You don't look so okay."
He stepped closer, his eyes riveted on one special zone. He didn't notice the razor in the woman's right hand. Not a cheap disposable either, a shiny, old-fashioned barber's blade. Blister's mangled mouth said,
"Jesus Christ, you are hot!"
He took two more foggy steps before Yancey roughly yanked him away, saving him from a more serious laceration. Amp and Lane Coolman stood on the side of Roosevelt, inspecting themselves for injuries. Buck Nance stayed back, leaning almost casually against the rear bumper of the damaged van.
"Hey, Bob!"
the red-headed driver shouted to Coolman, who raised his arms incredulously.
"You?"
he called back.
"Seriously?"
To Yancey, the woman said,
"I bumped you guys too hard, didn't I? It wasn't supposed to be a rollover, swear to God, but this was my first time doing a sprinter. The center of gravity on those suckers is ridiculous."
Yancey took the blade from her hand. "You probably ought to get out of here."
"I don't believe in leaving the scene, Andrew. That's not my style."
He bent down and kissed her. She grinned.
"But you were surprised, right? Never saw me coming."
"I'm truly blown away. You can pull your dress down now."
"Like you're not loving the view."
They heard a siren in the distance. Somebody who'd seen the accident had called 911. Yancey kicked Mary's razor underneath the Chrysler. Another car pulled over. The driver, a muscular young Hispanic man, said he was a paramedic. His wife and two small children were with him, a beach trip. He grabbed a medical bag from his trunk and ran to Blister, who shoved him away, bellowing,
"Ain't no goddamn beaner gonna stick a needle in me!"
Yancey walked over and knocked Blister flat. He flashed his Roach Patrol ID at the paramedic and said, "The man attacked you for no reason. That's what I just witnessed, and that's what I intend to tell the police. He was completely delirious, a menace to everyone. I'd appreciate it if you back me up on that." The paramedic said okay, though he was unnerved. Yancey put an arm around his shoulder, saying, "We're good here. Enjoy the rest of the day with your family."
"But dude, he's really fucked up,"
the man said, watching Blister wheeze and thrash on the pavement. "There's an ambulance on the way. After that, he's going to county." As soon as the paramedic left, Yancey dialed Rogelio Burton's number. He was leaving a colorfully detailed message when he heard Mary honking the horn. Blister was back on his feet, barreling toward the van. Yancey thought, "Not that fucking gun again." But that's what Blister went looking for, and found. He flew out of the sprinter, clutching the pistol with both hands, and steaming headlong toward Yancey, who could already hear Rosa's heartsick "I told you so." The two frayed Californians, Amp and Coolman, turned and ran. Yancey didn't blame them. He shouted for Mary to get down as he positioned himself between Blister and the Chrysler. The vision of a deranged dumbass waving a firearm scattered the gawking crowd of non-heroes that had been drawn to the crash site. Yancey widened his stance and braced for a bullet. The prospect of being killed in such a public place was depressing. All these goddamn tourists posting snapshots and videos. What a lousy way to go viral. Maybe the gun will jam, he thought, like in the movies. The gun didn't jam. It fired one last shot, which missed its target and lodged in a clown-themed snow cone truck across the street. This happened at the instant when Buck Nance, of all people, jumped Blister from behind and snapped his neck, like he was a damn chicken. Chapter 27 Playa Ramera was a well-known place for foreigners to connect with prostitutes until the Castro regime cracked down. These days, the beach was quiet, one of the loveliest in the Caribbean. On maps, the government had optimistically changed the name to Playa de Amor. All the sex cabanas were torn down. The honeymooning tumbrils, Daniel and Melody, walked holding hands along the dreamlike shore. They were excited to be together, far from their families and the gray Canadian winter. Neither of them had ever been to the tropics, so they took pictures of practically everything, even their own footprints in the sand. Daniel was 32, Melody 29. They'd met in the beer line at a Blue Jays game and wed 6 months later. As a gift, Daniel's mother offered them first-class tickets to the sunniest destination they could think of. The newlyweds chose Havana over Miami because they'd heard the crime rate in dictatorships was much lower. Melody aimed to get pregnant on the honeymoon, a family tradition. Daniel hadn't yet told her about his privately schooled child from a previous relationship, and this would be the focus of many future quarrels. For now, though, the tumbrils were close and carefree. "Is this amazing or what?" Melody said, skipping clear of an incoming wavelet. Daniel kicked at the water, shouting, "Let's not ever go home! Adios, Toronto!" Farther up the beach, Melody spotted a half-buried seashell that looked even pinker than the sand. She bent to pick it up, but it wouldn't budge. Daniel came over to help. They noticed two dark circles on the pink shell's surface. Melody said, "Look, Danny, somebody drew on it. Are those smiley faces?" The shell felt tough and rubbery when Daniel tried to pry it loose. He wondered if it was some exotic species of barnacle. "Maybe it's attached to something under the sand," his bride said. "Leave it there, honey. We'll go find another one." "No way." Daniel stoutly dropped to his knees. "I'm going to dig this sucker up." The policemen who arrived later were as shocked as the tumbrils, for tourist murders are extremely rare in Cuba. The pantless victim, who'd been strangled and buried, carried a U.S. passport and two soggy Cohiba knockoffs in the breast pocket of his linen suit jacket. The youngest of the Cuban police officers identified the artwork on the dead American scrotum as emoji characters. The following day, on a different beach, 257 nautical miles away, a man walking an unruly Irish setter received a phone call informing him that the body of Martin Trabeau had been found.
"That was quick," said Dominic Big Noogie Ayola.
He was annoyed, though not surprised, to learn that Trabeau had lied about having a high-ranking connection inside the Cuban government, that there was no secret source of sand that could be barged back to Florida for lucrative resale.
"Scum of the scum," Big Noogie said.
He hung up, thinking,
"At least the jack-off fixed my beach."
The Royal Pyrenees Hotel and Resort was rebounding toward a banner season. Big Noogie surveyed the cheerful crowds at the water's edge and wiggled his hairy toes in the sugary lushness of Trabeau's final delivery. Nearby, a bunch of kids scrambled to build a sandcastle, racing the tide. A man, war-painted with zinc sunblock, ambled up to the mobster and asked,
"What's your dog's name?"
"John,"
Big Noogie said.
Just plain John.
He must be smart. Where'd you get him trained?
Harvard.
No, really.
He's dumb as a turd, said Big Noogie. Really?
Farther down the beach lay Juveline on a garish floral print towel. She was rocking to Flo Rida and catching some rays. When Big Noogie sat down beside her, she plucked out her earbuds and said,
Don't stay mad, okay? Marty didn't mean shit to me, Noog. I just wanted to see Cuba.
Next time, call a travel agent. Don't bang a stranger.
Jesus, I said I was sorry like 1,000 fucking times.
Shut up. I gotta make a call. Then we'll grab some lunch.
Brock Richardson was home watching Deb pack her bags when his phone rang. He assured Big Noogie that everything had been taken care of.
Also, your friend Angelo has been added to our plaintiff list, he said.
I was just about to ask.
Dominic, when is your son's wedding? I'd like to send a gift.
Not necessary, Big Noogie said. We're all square. His guile's still creaming over that diamond.
I'm sure she is. It's a beauty.
Richardson said goodbye to Big Noogie and went outside for Deb's grand departure. She was taking one of his Porsches, so her bags didn't fit. A limo service had sent a Suburban to serve as the cargo escort. Deb had on the same hot Jimmy Choo's that she'd worn to Yancey's house the day the mutant rats scared her off. Yancey had mailed the shoes back with a note saying, You'll need these in your next life. To Brock, standing expressionless in the driveway, Deb said,
I'm sorry about this, but I really need some time alone to think.
She wasn't dressed for thinking. She was dressed for cocktails at the Delano. Richardson kissed her goodbye, saying,
I understand completely.
She was in a sulk because he hadn't dashed out and bought her a new engagement ring. It wasn't that he refused to do it. He just wasn't in a hurry. Her face was unstreaked by tears as she got in the Porsche and sped away, trailed by her luggage courier. Richardson went back inside and flopped onto the bed. The voice coming from the television was his own, cool and persuasive, cataloging the many gruesome side effects of Petrolux armpit gel.
And remember, the voice said, I'm not just your lawyer. I'm a fellow victim. Fucking A!
Brock Richardson cheered. On the nightstand was the portable, battery-powered blood pressure cuff. With a hungry grin, he reached for it. His housekeeper found him 5 hours later. He should have quit after 4. They named their new agency Ampergroat Kuhlman Legends, ACL for short. The square footage of the two side-by-side offices was identical, as was the window space. It was a starter suite on the 3rd floor, overlooking a drab stretch of Beverly Drive. Each of the partners had hot Asian assistants, with marketing degrees from Southern Cal and no patience for grab-ass. ACL lost its marquee client the very first week, when Buck Nance announced he was quitting television. Lane Kuhlman and John David Ampergroat begged him to reconsider. The network even offered to rip up his hefty new Bayou Brethren contract and double the money. Inconceivably, Buck said no. By killing his armed stalker, a violent street felon known as Benny the Blister, the Nance patriarch had been transformed in the public's eye from a rehabbing racist to a selfless civic hero. The media was delighted to forget about his repugnant performance at the Parched Pirate and the toxic YouTube diatribes. Buck was suddenly, according to People magazine, the most admired man in America.
He had courageously attacked and overpowered a trigger-happy maniac, saving the lives of God knows how many innocent bystanders, bystanders of all races, creeds, and sexual inclinations. A New York publisher offered him $2 million to do a book about what had happened in Key West. Buck was the big story. Buck was the bomb. And Buck was done. Hundreds of thousands of anguished fans circulated a "Come Home, Captain Cock" petition on social media, yet he remained unswayed. In an interview with Polka Radar Online, he disclosed that he was moving to Milwaukee and opening a music shop. He said his dream was to introduce young people to the joys of the accordion. To his credit, Buck never ratted out his brothers as Rombergs. Buddy and Cleroy inked new management deals with AMP. Junior and Miracle talked at length with ICM and CAA, but they ended up signing with Lane Kuhlman. Crystal Nance spent a week meditating under hot stones at Canyon Ranch before declaring that she, too, was quitting the show. Her replacement would be the crusty common-law widow of Buck Nance's psycho peckerhead stalker. Signing Mona Krill was Kuhlman's brainstorm, though he hadn't been able to track her down and get the deal nailed. For help, Kuhlman reached out to Andrew Yancey, thinking their mutual life-threatening adventures with Benny the Blister had forged some sort of man bond. He was mistaken. "Why won't you help me find her? Come on, bro," he pleaded. "I'm a busy guy," Yancey said. "Busy with what?" "Busting a sushi bar that's serving salmonella rolls, for starters. Then tomorrow it's a bagel joint where the sourdough smells like mangrove mud. This happens to be my job." Yancey spoke with no rancor. Kuhlman said, "Did I forget to mention we intend to pay you?" "In that case, I'll do it. For $2,500.
"Whoa!
That's my freelance fee these days."
"And you seriously won't cut me a break?"
"25 is what I need," Yancey said. "Yes or no, bro?"
"Fine, whatever. Lock it in."
"One more thing. My friend Miso, you promised to find her some work."
"She didn't tell you? I got her in that new Seth Rogen movie, the one they're shooting in Lauderdale," Kuhlman said. "She even has a line."
"Let's hear it."
"What's your problem, asshole?" And then she slaps Seth's face, only it's more like, "What's your problem, asshole?" Seth says she totally kills it.
I'd be stunned if she didn't.
"And FYI, it's not Miso anymore. It's Jane."
Yancey laughed and said, "A perfectly lovely name." Mona had quit Stoney's and was tending bar on Big Coppet. Every so often, Yancey saw her riding that droopy little bicycle along the highway. He drove down to the island at midnight and caught her at the end of her shift. As he anticipated, the news of Kuhlman's offer unofficially ended Mona's mourning period for Benny Krill. There was a bayfront condo waiting in Pensacola and premium roosters to be groomed.
"Sign my cracker ass up," she said.
The following afternoon, Yancey dropped her at Miami International and texted Kuhlman, who didn't respond immediately because he was at Square One in East Hollywood, having a civilized breakfast with his future ex-wife. He and Rachel had actually settled on a digestible number for the divorce payout. Their lawyers would pitch a hissy, but screw 'em. The informal negotiation was made possible because Rachel had landed a rich new boyfriend, an actor, not an agent, Kuhlman was relieved to learn. She promised him that she was done with payback nooners at the Wilshire, and he apologized for being a lousy, unfaithful husband. Later, watching his future ex-wife slide into a yellow Lambo driven by an impossibly buff young airhead, Kuhlman could only marvel at the durability of stereotypes. On the way back to the office, he called Yancey to thank him for locating Mona Krill, who, with so many rough edges, seemed destined for glory on Bayou Brethren. Yancey said, "I'm thrilled for all of you. Now please send me my money." He wanted to pay back Mary Mansfield, who'd loaned him the cash to close on Brock Richardson's lot. Yancey planned to retitle the property with a conservation easement so that nobody could build anything on it, not even a tiki hut, for all eternity. Rogelio Burton had told him that he was crazy, that he could resell the land for at least $100,000. "Sell it to who? Another shit weasel like Richardson?" Yancey said. "I'd rather just plant some buttonwoods and watch them grow." The detective pressed his friend to explain why a savvy Miami attorney would unload a prime lot in the Florida Keys for a ludicrous fraction of its true value. Yancey failed to exude innocence when he replied, "Panic sale, Rog."
"And what would be the cause of Mr. Richardson's panic?"
"Possibly the Calzone crime family, but that's only a guess." Burton said,
"Oh, fuck. Forget I asked."
Specifically, a man named Dominic Aola. His associates fondly call him Big Noogie. One day, his service dog got loose at Mallory Square, and I brought it back to him. He seemed keen on repaying the favor.
"Andrew, this subject is now closed forever. Don't say one word about this to anybody, not a fucking soul, unless you want to spend what's left of your pitiful career scraping dead roaches and mouse shit off your shoes."
Yancey wanted Burton to know it was Dominic Aola who'd set the property's purchase price at the absurd figure of $2,500.
"Hell, I would have jumped on it even at fair market," he said. "That's the truth, Rog." "And paid for it how?"
"I don't know. Sell my Picassos?"
"Sonny wants to see you for lunch. Try not to let it slip that your new BFF is a mafioso."
The sheriff set the meeting at Stoney's Crab Palace, of all places, which Yancey had shut down once again due to cavorting bacteria. Tommy Lombardo had overruled the closure, allowing Brennan to reopen the dining area on the condition that all tuna entrees were 86'd until the lab reports came back from the CDC. When Yancey arrived, Sonny Summers was at a two-top, morosely scanning the menu.
"What looks good?" Yancey joked.
"The door."
"This isn't a restaurant. It's a fungus factory. Why'd you pick this god-awful joint?"
"Because I knew there wouldn't be a crowd," answered the sheriff, who preferred not to be seen with Yancey.
Out of gastric caution, they ordered bottled beer and scorched chicken. Yancey commended Sonny Summers for his poise at the press conference, announcing that the conch train case had been solved, and that the assailant of Abdul Halim Shamoon was the same dirtbag who died at the hands of Buck Nance in the melee on South Roosevelt.
"Strange," the sheriff said to Yancey, "but I never got the whole story about that traffic accident."
"Meaning how I happened to be driving the Sprinter? It was all in the report. Benny Krill snatched me at gunpoint from outside the pier house. Kuhlman, Amper Grote, the bodyguard, they all backed me up on that. Didn't you read their statements?"
"Andrew, I honestly don't want to know how you ended up in the middle of this particular goat fuck. All I care about is that your name was all over the goddamn media. Again."
"I'm not getting my badge back, am I?"
"This can't possibly come as a shock to you."
The food arrived, and Sonny Summers tentatively bit into a drumstick. Yancey flailed onward. "You had a dead tourist, tons of bad press, and nobody in custody. Now, the homicide solved, the bad guy's deceased, and the victim's family is sitting there with Matt Lauer thanking you personally for closure. Meanwhile, your only opponent in the sheriff's race dropped out, which means the election's a done deal. Sonny, you've got the damn job locked for another 4 years. What do you have to lose by hiring me back on the force?" The sheriff took a hasty slug of beer and swished it around his mouth. Yancey waited until he was done.
Sonny, this case got closed because I found Benny Krill. It was me on his dumb redneck ass, not your guys.
But see, unfortunately, you ended up in the dumb redneck's custody, not the other way around. If it wasn't for Buck Nance, Krill would have shot you dead in the street.
Point is, I was ready to take a bullet from that shitbird.
The words came out with an edge of futility that Yancey had hoped to conceal. Brennan slunk up to the table to ask if they were enjoying their meals. Yancey told him to go away. The sheriff gave up on lunch, saying,
"This could be buzzard meat for all I know."
"Be straight with me, Sonny. Is there something else in play here?"
"The woman driving the other car? The one who hit the Sprinter van?"
"I remember, sure. What about her?"
"The driver's license she gave was a fake. We still don't know her real name."
Yancey felt an icy twisting in his gut.
"That Junker Chrysler she had?"
Sonny Summers went on.
"It came from a repo yard in Liberty City. The registration in the glove box was forged."
"Okay, but what's that got to do with me? I was in the vehicle that got smashed, remember? The one that flipped." Deep breaths, Yancey was telling himself. Stay cool.
"Do you know the other driver, Andrew?"
"What are you talking about?"
"Three of the witnesses at the scene said they saw you kiss her."
"Oh, that." Yancey offered a penitent nod. "We're talking about an exceptionally good-looking woman, Sonny. I mean, overpoweringly attractive. Still, I get that it wasn't a smart move." The sheriff's expression made clear that his doubts about Yancey's fitness for duty had once again been validated.
"I assume you got her phone number," he said dryly.
"Nope, just a kiss.
Hope she was worth it."
Sonny Summers signaled for the lurking Brennan to bring the check. Yancey asked, "What do I need to do to get another chance?"
"Stay away from trouble, for Christ's sake. It's really not that hard."
The drive home made Yancey feel better. At every bridge, the water seemed a different shade of blue. The winter sky was bright as an egg and spangled with birds. Yancey loved the evocative roll call of the lower keys. Big Coppet, Sugarloaf, Cudjoe, Ramrod, Little Torch. Here was one blessed stretch of the highway that hadn't yet been blighted by fast food chains, box stores, and strip malls. That shit was coming, though. Everybody said so. When he reached Big Pine, he turned down Key Deer Road, and from there to his house he counted one deer and seven damn iguanas. Mary's rental, a new Accord, was parked beside his skiff. She was sunning in a beach chair beside a tall, frosty drink. Her tank suit flashed like a chrome streamer from the rail where she'd flung it.
"You're burning your little bumblebee," Yancey said.
She reached behind her and patted the tattoo.
"All yours, mister, as advertised."
It still flustered him a bit, the A-Y on her butt cheek. He went inside for a beer. When he came out, she was sitting up, legs locked, yoga style.
"Can we officially call this place an estate?" she said, "now that you've got all this land?"
"I'm going to pay you back, don't worry. There's a check coming from California."
"So I can cancel your beatdown? Good, I'll tell my guys."
He said, "Rosa called today. She's taken up with the butcher's apprentice."
"Get out!"
"It's borderline quaint. Better than a ski instructor, at least." Mary wrapped herself in a towel.
"You sad? Of course you are, Andrew. Stop pretending you're not."
Sad he was, though not blindsided, he'd known that Rosa wouldn't come back to Florida, just as he'd known that he could never move somewhere as cold and tame as Oslo. Their conversation had been painful, but not shattering. She said the butcher's apprentice was named Oli, rhyming with roly-poly, which conjured an image Yancey could live with. "Let's go out in the boat," he said.
"Oh, I know what that means. Wild rebound sex. Men are so freaking predictable."
"It'll be chilly on the water. Where's your fleece, Mary?" They trailered the skiff to Bahia Honda and set out on the gulf side. The wind was westerly and mild, so Yancey steered for the horseshoes. He backed off the throttle because he wanted the ride to go on and on.
"Wouldn't it be cool to find a shipwreck?" Mary said.
"You already did."
"Shut up, Andrew. You're going to be fine."
"There's something I've got to ask. Was your plan to kill Benny Krill with that razor blade?" Mary shook her head.
"The plan was to stop him, that's all. It was time for everybody to move on."
"Will you please tell me your real name?"
"I should kick your sorry ass for asking me that."
She leaned close, holding on to him with both arms as the skiff bumped through a choppy patch of waves. Her long red hair blew wildly in the breeze, tickling his neck. He could see his own reflection in her sunglasses. That's how he knew he was smiling. This is John Rubenstein. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Razor Girl by Carl Hyacin. This program was directed by Gabrielle DeQueer. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2016 by Carl Hyacin. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.